This is the Change Leadership Podcast with Brett Dawson, in which I explore change leadership and management from different perspectives. It's a bit like examining a Rubik's Cube from different angles. Let's face it, change is difficult, so let's see if we can make it easier. In today's episode, I'm talking to Kerry Birchall, who is a leadership coach and a communications specialist. I'm going to be talking about how stress builds up in the relationship stress zones and leads to breaking points that can be avoided with good communication skills. Kerry and I talk about what prevents good communication and what you can do to improve communication. We specifically talk about the importance of active listening, psychological safety, and being vulnerable when having difficult conversations. Kerry has this wonderful talent for contextualizing her learning points with some of her stories about her leadership coaching and life experiences. So without any further delay, let's get right into it. Kerry Birchall, welcome to the Change Management Show.
Thank you so much, Brett. I'm honored and excited to be here.
I wonder if you could just give us a quick introduction to yourself and tell the audience about the work that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was just joking with you before we pressed record that I'm quite proud of this perfect puppy that we have, who I promise will be quiet during the podcast. We live in San Antonio, Texas, and my journey to the leadership development work that I do really morphed out of a prior career in middle school education and administration, and then some HR work as organizational development director, and ultimately until to this space where I really help leaders and teams slow down to go fast. And that really drives at interpersonal communication and how we can leverage better communication to have more trust and productivity and innovation and all the things that we kind of need now. But we often don't slow down to have that real important communication, which, like you know, creates those breaking points.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading your website a little bit earlier and just looking at how you articulated the fact that there's so much happening, people get into overwhelmed situations. All those stars are busy moving around and getting everybody confused and in a spin. And it's all about just slowing down and stopping and stepping back from it and looking at the big picture and rethinking and resetting.
Yeah. You know, recently I was working with a client, Brett, and I remembered this story. It's an urban legend of a frog. Have you ever heard about the frog in the pot of water?
Yes. Yeah. I think I have. But for the benefit of anybody who hasn't, please relate it.
All right. So
I want to hear your version of the story.
Yeah, well, that's true. I might elaborate a little bit. Imagine that there's a frog in a pot of water sitting on the stove and the frog's splashing around and doing frog-like things, but somebody comes along and just turns on the element and slowly the frog gets warmer and warmer and hotter and ultimately boils. And you can guess the frog dies, right? But the frog didn't see what was coming as that temperature slowly rose. And conversely, the urban legend says that if you had a pot of boiling water and you dumped the frog in, the frog is going to like snap to, jump out, you know, keep living a happy frog life. And I think that is just so much what we face in the day-to-day spin of leadership and life. And I kind of define leaders as anybody who is in a position of influence. So as a parent, you are a leader. As a community member, you're a leader. As somebody in a corporate setting or working with a team, And gosh, that day-to-day spin can just be this gradual increase of temperature in the water. And I think my work with leaders and teams is really slowing down so we recognize, like, how hot is that water? Are we having fun splashing around or it's starting to boil? We need to rally together and get out of the pot.
The way I see this is I look at it from a change management point of view, looking at how change seems to be accelerating. And the pace of change is just absolutely relentless. And it's very easy to get caught up in constantly adapting, constantly treading water, constantly trying to just survive and adapt and cope. And that is in itself overwhelming and challenging.
Yeah. You know, years ago, I was in a conference and they were talking about how the generational span has shrunk. So I could say, like, my partner is a fifth generation Irish guy. Well, now we're defining generations as like a number of years, like 3 to 5 years, because technology is aging the generations so much faster, where, you know, prior generations were not really marked by, but there weren't that many significant innovations that quickly to mark generations as quickly as they're seeing them now. So to your point about change, like even how we measure change in sort of society and by generations is radically different than it was even two generations ago.
That's really an interesting point. I've never really thought of generations as a rate of change rather than a specific lifespan, because typically within a lifespan, things were quite constant. There was a time not that long ago where you could work in the same job doing the same type of thing for a very long time, and that would be your career.
Yes.
And things have radically changed from since then.
And as much as we say it's generational, I don't know that it is sort of the generation and the character traits of the generation as much as all these other variables that combine create an environment where there is lots of, you know, people don't stay. I was thinking this morning, I saw a post on LinkedIn about a colleague of mine who's starting a new job. And I thought, well, 2 years ago, she was in a different job and she's in her 50s, right? And just how today, gosh, you stay in a job 5 years and that looks like a legend.
I was just thinking of software updates and how software changes so quickly that you can get to a point where if you've been away from software for 2-3 years, you need to almost retrain on it to be able to get back up to speed and become proficient in it. Mm-hmm. And that in itself could be a generational defining type of attribute.
Right. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Breaking points. You were talking about breaking points earlier. I wanted to know whether you have experienced any breaking points in your life or your career.
Yeah. So, gosh, great question.
I sometimes put crossroads and breaking points into the same category.
Mm-hmm. As my sister would describe them, you know, you have sort of life before that point and then things after. And so my head jumps to a couple of really pivotal things in my life, professionally and personally, and I think they often intersect. In our early 30s, my partner and I were feeling like things were a little too comfortable, a little too stable. We lived in Western Canada and great social circle. We played ball hockey and volleyball, and I was fast-tracked as administrator in middle school, and he was a chiropractor with hospital privileges, which never happened. And so we thought, gosh, I don't want to hit the ceiling in my mid-30s, late-30s. Like, let's change it up so that we are still contributing to whatever the bigger picture was. So I applied for a teaching job at a NATO base in Belgium, Brussels, and he applied for med school. And we sort of said, let's just see wherever it goes. And the outcome of that choice created a breaking point in that I had to grow and develop at a rate that was way faster than anything in my very predictable teaching unionized setting in Canada. So I did not get the job teaching. My husband did get into med school. So we ended up moving to the Caribbean for 2 years, because when you start med school at 39, you don't get into a school in Canada or really a lot of North American schools in general. So Caribbean for 2 years, New York City for 2 years. I was administrator in persistently dangerous middle schools. Teachers were calling 911 during class change. It was crazy. Like, unlike anything I'd seen in Canada. Then we moved to Detroit. By then, the recession was full blown. I started coaching teachers in really difficult schools, literally boarded up windows, you know, and recognizing like structures drive behaviors. Of course, these kids are going to misbehave in the brokenness of these schools that I was, you know, coaching teachers in. And then we had a year in Baltimore during the race riots. And then about 5 years in rural Illinois in organizational development roles in HR. And now we're in San Antonio, where I'm just solo entrepreneur. But had I not leaned in 2006 to that opportunity to say life is a little too comfortable, am I positioned to contribute in ways that I'm going to be proud of when I'm 80? You know, it was a breaking point. And people thought we were crazy. I mean, talk about going slow to go fast. I had to, and my mom and I joke about this now, but I tried multiple times to have a really tough conversation with her, because her comments were just negative, and she didn't want me to leave the country at the end of the day, right? She didn't want me to walk away from a career that was really stable. She herself was a teacher in the same school board. And, you know, had I not slowed down to say to her, Mom, your comments inspire fear, and really like rally the support around me that I needed to push through that breaking point, I wouldn't be the richer, deeper, stronger, more enlightened person that I am today. I would never have done the entrepreneurial lifestyle that I have, which I love. But when I think about that teacher and that administrator in a unionized school setting that never had to negotiate for a raise and never had to go to companies and say, hey, this is how much I charge, this is the value I bring to the table. Wow. Like, thank goodness I pushed through that breaking point, because it's a different world now. I'm a different person. And I want to say maybe not better, but like deeper. And I can love better.
Oh, that's beautiful. Couple of points strike me. One is going to med school at the age of 39. Wow.
Yeah.
That takes a lot.
I say we did med school. But really, I'm so proud of my husband. Like, he is a rock star. Just amazing. But yeah, what courage on his part. I mean, talk about breaking points.
I can relate to the we, because any type of school like that or going to do a business degree, MBA, takes a huge amount of time and commitment. And it's a team effort, because the person that's doing that needs support. Without that support, it's just so much harder.
Yeah, true.
The other thing that struck me about what you were saying was you were talking about the learning. And the thing that I've realized about change management and dealing with change and adapting to change is it's all about learning. It's about being able to learn what you need to know in the new situation, mm-hmm. to be able to adapt to it,
yeah,
to be able to cope, to be able to move past coping to thriving.
Yes, yes. And there's an interplay there, I think, Brett, between knowing, like learning something and knowing what needs to happen. And then also sort of the grit or the resilience or the gumption to just like apply what you've learned. I was with a cable manufacturing company yesterday. We have worked together for a couple of years, and we reviewed some of the big leadership concepts that they've learned over the time. And I was really charging them with learning it is not enough. Like, we have to be intentional about applying the learning in the situations that's going to leverage, you know, the best employee experience in their plan that they wanted. And so, yeah, we don't get anywhere without the learning. I've got 15 years of post-secondary education. I'm a junkie when it comes to education. Still, it means nothing unless I slow down enough to apply it and integrate it with my character and the situation and all that good stuff.
Yeah, that sounds good. You've read my book.
I have.
I wanted to talk about relationship stress zones and the effect that stress has on people.
Yeah.
So for the benefit of the listeners, the relationship stress zones is a model that I've taken as an analogy from the steel industry, in which steel is tested to the point of breaking. The thing that's really interesting about that is that the steel goes through a test piece that's been tested, goes through various phases. So in the first phase, it's very elastic. And when you release it, it goes back to its original size. And if you keep pulling it, it gets into plastic deformation, where the size actually changes. It starts lengthening, the cross-sectional diameter starts changing. And if you release it at that point, it doesn't go back to its original size. It's actually changed its shape. And if you continue to put it under strain and pressure and stress, and you keep pulling it, it gets to a point where there's so much strain that it actually starts necking. The cross-sectional area starts changing shape to the point where that's where it actually breaks and it snaps. And so what I've done is I've taken that analogy, I've put it into the book, and I've described those various stages as being the elastic phase, which is the idealistic phase that relationships go into, especially when you first meet somebody or when you go into a new working environment, you've got a new boss that you're working for, a new supervisor, and everybody wants to be in the best possible space. Nobody wants to rock the boat. Everything needs to be, you know, as smooth as possible. But realistically, that's such an idealistic relationship, and it never actually lasts, and it can't last, because there are practical elements that need to get into the relationship. Relationships that work need to be negotiated. Negotiations around how things work, how you work together, what the boundaries are, what's okay, what isn't okay. And that's a collaborative type of exercise. And if those negotiations, so that plastic deformation stage is the negotiation stage. And if that negotiation doesn't work well, or if it's not very effective, what can happen is you start going into conflict. And conflict that is sustained over a long enough period of time gets to that breaking point where somebody just becomes completely disengaged, and they decide, okay, that's it. I'm not part of this anymore. This is not working for me. I don't want to be here. And that's where you get a disengagement. Often when it comes to employees, it manifests as a drop-off in engagement. And that's where you get into the territory of actually losing those resources. That's where employee retention becomes a problem, where people leave. Now, having discussed it with you and reflected on this, the one magical element that works its way through all of this that is required is the communication aspect. Because when you're negotiating, you need to be able to communicate effectively to be able to negotiate effectively. And the same thing is when you get into conflict situations, is you need to be able to communicate effectively to be able to resolve the conflict. And this is the reason why I wanted to talk to you on this podcast episode, because you are a communication specialist. And in my view, it is absolutely essential. Communication is like, it's everything. So tell me a bit about your view on communication and how important it is in work environments, in relationships, hierarchical relationships where there's a power dynamic, peer-to-peer relationships.
Yeah. Yeah, I say all the time, Brett, that healthy relationships have equal power. And regardless of role, that equal power sets the stage for everyone to share their thoughts, negotiate, debate, you know, express what they want to do. And hierarchies in environments where there's not a lot of psychological safety, that hierarchy can create the power dynamic that really gets in the way of that great communication. So yes, to all your points. I mean, for those listeners, I have this file on my computer that's called Brett's Brilliance with all these different concepts and, you know, the edits of the book that I've read. I mean, just, I love your analogies, Brett, and how they really capture the change process and really dive into what leads up to those breaking points. And so when I think of communication as it relates to that model, it is so hard to go slow, to go fast, which is what we need to do in communication. Another way of thinking that is simple is hard, right? When we're in conflict, we often pontificate for a while. Like we elaborate, we get complicated, we throw out a bunch of examples, and just how do we keep it simple so that other people can hear us? And that means that you got to strip away the ego, which is so hard. Like, talk about emotional intelligence, right? I was thinking about our work together this morning, and this book called Humble Inquiry. It's by Edgar Schein. He is an academic, but man, does he have this simple is hard. He can write simply despite how smart he is. And this concept of humble inquiry really gets at that idea of, you know, I need to hear what you say first before I respond. I need you to know that I've heard what you say, which is just the very simple skill of active listening, which I say all the time with my clients. Active listening is the hardest soft skill there is to develop. And in many cases, we want to respond before we actively listen. And that gets in the way of communication and adds to breaking points and kind of stretches that elasticity that you talk about.
So what would you say? Why is active listening so difficult?
I think it is that ego that all of us have, right? Where, I mean, I could even say to a friend who calls and says, I got pulled over with a speeding ticket. Oh, no way. Are you kidding? I got a ticket a year ago, but I got only a warning. And all of a sudden, I've not even listened to my friend saying, oh my gosh, I've got a speeding ticket. Hear the stress in their voice. Listen to what that, validate what their experience is. And I think it's hard because I want to make sense of what you're talking about through my own experiences, which biases what I hear you say to begin with. It biases it through my lens, right? And so if my friend says, I got a speeding ticket, wow, like, where were you when that happened? How, you know, it's, I hear the stress in your voice. You sound really still rattled by it, blah, blah, blah. Maybe I learned that the experience wasn't great. It was during a construction zone. It was triple the cost. Like, I don't know what has her rattled or him rattled about this speeding ticket, but I need to hear them first if I'm going to understand that. And then in the end, maybe it has nothing to do with the warning I got last year, right? So, it, you know, translate that to a working environment. I'm working with the police department right now on some culture stuff. And from my helicopter view, I can tell that everyone is deeply committed to the police work. I love this department. I'm a huge supporter of police and the good work that they do. And I can see that these levels of leadership are not connecting, in part because they haven't slowed down to hear each other first. We're busy reacting to the decisions of one hand or the other hand. Now, in all fairness, things in the environment currently that impact our ability to connect and slow down and truly communicate is short staffing, the pace of change that we talked about earlier, the variables in the environment, like COVID has really created an urgency to recover that lots of companies are really feeling pressured by. And so we want to recover by doing more of the same, more of our best stuff from pre-COVID, which is not going to get us into a healthy state of recovery. We need innovation. And for that innovation to happen, we need communication. For the communication to happen, we need to kind of push these variables and environmental pressures aside for a second and have this oasis where we slow down and communicate and hear each other before we respond. Oof, it is hard work. And in a lot of cases, I think, can't be done without some facilitation in the early stages. Like, my role is definitely to come into messy situations and help stabilize things so that the teams can carry on. But initially, sometimes when things have been really inside out, upside down, it takes an outside objective person to kind of slow the group down to point out, hey, you're not really hearing each other. You're not really listening.
Yeah. The first step in any transformation process to me is awareness. So it's awareness about the fact that there is a lack of active listening taking place.
Yes.
And communicating that with teens, that must be quite a tricky thing to do, because it's so easy to take things as criticism rather than listening to it from the point of view of, oh, this is something I can take on board and work on.
Yeah. You know, I felt really...
How do you navigate that dynamic?
Yeah. I felt really honored lately because one of my clients gave me the feedback, and you could tell he's a bit of a tough nut. And he said, I've told my team, like, we've had other people come through here, but Carrie's legit. Like, she really wants to help us. And I reflected on that, A, really powerful feedback, and B, where does that perception come from? And I realize it's through my process, which is one-on-one interviews with everybody that's involved. So this police department, as an example, is, you know, 17 leaders. It's a small department. I've got 61 pages of single space type notes, hearing what people's experiences are at work, just hearing. That's it. And as a result, I think that builds some trust. And when I push back and sort of point out patterns that I see throughout the 61 pages, people can kind of accept that a little bit easier because they felt heard. I also use a culture survey that is really powerful. It's only 5 questions. So not to compete with engagement surveys or anything else. This really looks at anxiety, well-being, and culture. And we're using that as a gauge to create more awareness. And both cases, right, me interviewing and having sort of fireside chats with people and the culture survey are both really objective. And they're from someone who's not in the trench and not invested in whatever the outcome is. And so people let me, you know, kind of nudge them a little bit more than they might otherwise.
So how do you coach and encourage active listening?
Honestly, sometimes I'm what would normally be seen as disrespectful, but because I've slowed down and people feel heard and they have that trust, I can, middle of the conversation, interrupt people and say, hang on, you haven't heard them. What do you hear them? And I'll just get bold and clear, really in the moment, saying, we're going to active listen. Of course, we do like all that work of what are our norms and the rules and how do we create a safe environment, blah, 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 all of that stuff. But when the rubber hits the road, I am the objective outsider that people let me come in and kind of poke the bear and interrupt them. Because even in the interviews, people are saying, like, I want to get better at this. I love the stuff you're helping us learn. I love, you know, the time that we have together. And then I'm frustrated when we start doing like the messy work of talking with each other, actually communicating. Yeah, because, you know, whatever the department is, I mean, it could be any department that I'm working with, they're, you know, at a breaking point. That's why they've invited me in. And so we're going to deconstruct that breaking point and help them be in a safe and healthy pattern.
That reminds me how important coaching is, because it's all very well and fine reading the principles of what active listening or any other skill is in a book and then trying to practice it. That's a second level. But actually having the coaching intervention while you are mid-stride, I think that's incredibly invaluable.
Mm. And I always feel like I'm sweating when I do that, because it feels so bold on my end. And people are so grateful, right? Because they have blind spots and they know enough to know that they have blind spots, but they're blind spots. They don't see them until you say, hang on. Like yesterday, I was with just a one-on-one client that I have, and I listened to a one-on-one employee meeting and was there on Zoom. So video off, muted. I didn't say anything, but really tracked what the leader was saying to the employee, how the leader responded to the employee's nonverbal, verbal, blah, blah, blah. We follow up with a coaching 30-minute debrief, and the leader was just like, wow, I totally get the pattern that I've been in, you know, but without sitting in and watching them in action. And then, you know, that same day kind of giving feedback, it was, you know, you just don't know what you don't know. And you're unintentionally creating breaking points. Of course, that's why everyone is asking for help, because we don't want breaking points. They're stressful. They're not fun. Get me out of this breaking point.
Yeah, absolutely. Problem with breaking points is it drives disengagement and
Right.
It breaks down commitment, and that just causes all sorts of problems, because when somebody's not actually committed to the process or the learning, it's never going to happen.
Yes, true. It's a challenge with the clients that I have to get them in a space where they want to let go, where they can let go. You're right. Nobody's happy in that space. And we spin until we feel heard. So if I'm carrying around something from 10, 15, 20 years ago, I'm going to keep spinning around that feeling or that hurt until someone acknowledges it. And in the same breath, you can't acknowledge 20 years of interactions that have been a little bit toxic, right? And so where's the challenge of saying, can I just like broadly say, I want to be better. Can we try on a fresh slate? You know, can you at least start having little bits of interaction where we make some momentum together?
Yeah, I can see how important trust is, but obviously trust needs to be built at the beginning. I wanted to ask, you mentioned something about safety and psychological safety. That's something that is always an issue in groups and in work environments. Tell me a bit more about psychological safety.
Yeah, so
how would you define it as a start, and then how does it play a role in communication?
So I would define psychological safety as that space where you feel like you're allowed to think and feel whatever you think and feel without retribution, without retaliation. And you're letting other people think and feel what they think without it like being targeted at you. So it's psychological safety doesn't come from an environment where it's a free-for-all and we can just, you know, say mean things because I'm allowed to think and feel whatever I say. It's really that environment where I'm trying to communicate things so that I can move past them. And in order for me to move past them, I need you to know how it impacted me. And I trust that you're going to be open to that. And we're going to lean into this dialogue. So definitely some boundaries going into those teams where maybe there hasn't been a real pattern of psychological safety. And part of, I think, Brett, what I really try to focus on in there is that appreciative inquiry concept where you're appreciating the good stuff. I say all the time that what we spend time on is what grows. So people can bring forward pain points or experiences or patterns that they've seen in each other. The fact that they're bringing them up says that they want to work through it. And so as a facilitator, I'm going to focus more on their drive to create a better future, their drive to work through things over reiterating and hammering and dissecting all of the pain points. The bigger message is, gosh, thank you for the trust bringing it up. Your courage at bringing it up says you want to work through it. Let's work through it and drive them to the future.
So I've worked in corporates, and some of them are quite well-known organizations, international organizations. I have on numerous occasions been in situations where I have not felt the psychological safety to make a statement or a comment because I was so worried about how it would impact on two things. One is how that would reflect on other people. So systems and processes that are not working, where if you start pointing this out, is that going to be perceived as some form of criticism? And then that is going to be a problem because it makes the individual look bad or the organization look bad. And you're doing it in a public environment, like a group of people, even though you know those people, there's also that feeling of, you know, is it actually safe to say that? And then obviously the concern of, is this going to be used against me at a later stage? Is it going to be held against me? Is there going to be some, you know, subjective influence on my next appraisal? There's all sorts of stuff going on there.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering how you create a climate in which people are willing to take on things and to start learning and to make contributions to improving systems and processes.
Yeah.
I've just been in the right mindset to be receptive to those types of discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's four tenets of psychological safety that are good barometers for where a team is at in that. And this comes from Premier. It's a consulting group. They use these in healthcare, though I find it super applicable everywhere. So the first one is, anyone can ask questions without looking stupid. Anyone can ask for feedback without looking incompetent. Anyone can be respectfully critical without appearing negative. And the last one is anyone can suggest innovative ideas without being perceived as disruptive. So when we have any of those things that are missing, then the innovation, the teamwork, the problem solving sort of becomes a bit diluted. And so as a leader or a consultant in those teams, one of the strategies that is really helpful is to create that space where people listen first. So in your examples, you know, corporate settings, science especially, right, data-driven, we get a set of data and we think, gosh, we need to respond to this data because it's going to impact the outcome X. And based on my piece of the project, the data is right. And my perception that it's going to impact X is accurate. And pulling back and saying, okay, well, I have one part of this project, and slowing down to say, I need to understand a bit more about other people's data points and fill in the puzzle pieces, right? Just because I maybe have like the border of the puzzle doesn't mean that I really understand the whole picture. And so asking questions first versus sharing your data and sharing your conclusions, putting that aside and asking more information, getting more data, learning more about things, and then eventually finding a place where your data can connect with someone else's data. And it becomes a bit of a snowball effect. The fun expression that I have to capture that is the ask hole, A-S-K hole, right? So I might appear manipulative if I said to a coworker, well, what does data Y tell us about this? You know, well, I've just made that person the ask hole because I'm asking them a question and their data isn't favorable, right? And so I'm making them the ask hole. They're going to be defensive. They don't want to answer, versus just asking more questions a little bit broader about that. Like, how does X impact Y? What other data points are we considering getting? How come we chose that data? Like really, truly being humbly inquisitive to say, I know I don't know everything about this project. I know everything about my piece of it. And I have some conclusions about my piece of it. And I'm right about what I know. Pulling back and saying, I need to have that humble space to still ask more questions and not put somebody on the spot asking questions about what I know their shortfalls are, but really honestly being humble to say, I'd like to learn more about your piece.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was wondering what else inhibits people from communicating effectively.
Yeah, it's the not feeling valued, not feeling like their contributions are appreciated, not feeling safe, right? So, you know, really simply, how does all that really boil down? Not feeling heard. So I feel like, let's say you and I are having a conversation, Brett, and you say, I'm starting this podcast and I'm really excited about it. And I'm like, oh, good for you. I'm on a new project too. And I start talking about my thing. I have not validated your work at all. Are you ever going to invite me on your podcast? No. Thankfully, we have a good trusting relationship. And we slow down to like, tell me more about the podcast. You know, I'd be interested in contributing. Is there a space? What's your specialty? What's my specialty? And luckily for me, you've invited me on the podcast. But if I just jumped and said, oh, good for you, you're starting a podcast, I'm starting this other thing, we would have never connected and we wouldn't have felt valued. So, you know, I know that you feel valued in our work together. I feel valued being here, and we can morph and do more projects in the future together because we've slowed down to really hear each other.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The other thing I wanted to ask about was things that empower communication, that enable communication.
Yeah, good question. Very simply answered is the willingness and the openness to be vulnerable. So here's like a fun story. In our travels and all those different places, my husband and I had this irrational expectation that we would move to a new city that we'd never been in, and within 36 hours, buy or rent something to live in. So we'd never been to the Caribbean before med school. We'd never been to New York City. We'd never been to Detroit. We'd never been to Baltimore. And within 36 hours, we found something. And then we moved to Southern Illinois, you know, same thing, bought a house quickly, ended up being a bit of a lemon house. So we sold it after a couple of years and bought something else. In our looking for the house that we ended up buying, the second house in Southern Illinois, it took weeks, months, My husband is frustrated with me. We've boiled it down. We know my three priorities, his three priorities. He's a firm believer of the happy wife, happy life, right? So I am, you know, sort of getting to pick the house, if you will. And I'm not picking a house. And we're going back and forth and back and forth. And we're staying on the surface of our, what's the problem here? We've agreed on the top three things. Just pick something, right? And I remember one day we're driving around with the realtor, feeling frustrated. There's not a lot of quality houses, blah, blah, blah. And he finally says to me, I don't get it. What's the problem here? And I lean into that vulnerability and I say to him, I am trying to decide if I'm worthy of the house I want. And it changed everything. He went, okay.
Wow.
Yeah. And I wasn't giving myself permission to be honest about what was my hang up. And he wasn't slowing down to sort of actively listen to, like, I see you doing this pattern, Carrie. We've agreed and you're reluctant. I'm not sure what the reluctance is about, but you keep being reluctant and, you know, and kind of helping me see how I was showing up. He wasn't listening because I say all the time, Brett, that we can actively listen to the words and the actions of people. And I wasn't aware, right? So I couldn't create the change. And then just in that moment, just thought, gosh, I need to be vulnerable here. And even though he's frustrated with me in the process, he's not frustrated with me and, you know, trusting the relationship of 28 years that we have. And it changed, and we got a really beautiful house, and it sold right away when we left Southern Illinois, because it was just a great pick and some really good memories there, but I had to lean into it. Yeah. And so how does vulnerability really, really help that? Right. I think of times in my career where I've gone to my leader and said, I don't feel valued. It's a bold thing to say to a leader, but together we had to work on what that meant and what her role was in sort of being a catalyst for those feelings, what my role was in getting out of the victim mindset around that and, you know, shifting. But if we're not ready to honestly communicate and be vulnerable, we're going to spin all day long looking at houses and looking at houses and looking at houses. We're not ever going to find the house.
It takes a lot of courage to go to somebody to say something like that, especially if you don't necessarily have the answers. I think that's one of the problems we have, especially, you know, tertiary educated professionals. You kind of feel and expect that you always need to have answers. And being vulnerable and saying, this is how I feel about something, but not fully understanding it, where that actually needs to be explored with the other person, that takes a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I reflect on one of my earlier tough conversations in the corporate setting. It was with a VP, and his team had approached me and asked for help because they really felt micromanaged by this vice president. And so I had zero interaction with the vice president, but needed to have a coaching conversation with him around, like, dude, people think you micromanage, what's going on? And I remember at the onset of that meeting, he'd come to my office. We were sitting in my little chairs. The ambiance was good, blah, blah, blah. But all of those mechanical things are nothing until you're vulnerable. And I said to him, you know, we haven't worked very much together. I'm nervous about this conversation. I have something that's delicate that I want to bring up with you. And it, like, instantly his nonverbals changed. We had a deep conversation. He leaned into it, but I had to own, I'm a little nervous talking with you. Like, I just own whatever my piece was in that interaction. And it shifted everything in that conversation. And we ended up having just a really rich relationship over the years I was there.
That is amazing. The image that came to me is the fact that as professionals, we often wear masks.
Yeah.
We feel that we need to be a certain type of person in an environment.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's when you can step away from that and actually be yourself and own your that aspect of vulnerability.
Yeah.
That's where the magic seems to happen.
Yeah.
And the thing that amazes me about that is, you know, the response in that situation wasn't somebody becoming defensive or judging you because of the way that they actually, you know, went with it.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that isn't the case with most people, if most people aren't just naturally going to be a lot more willing to be open and vulnerable if you're willing to be prepared and be vulnerable with them.
Yes, you're spot on. I read years and years ago, 90% of people really want to work through communication, meaning 10% of the people thrive on communication. So even if I went to that VP and I said, gosh, I'm really nervous about this conversation. It's delicate. I, you know, have some feedback I want to give you. And he went ballistic. What do you mean? Who are you? I'm fine. You know what? Even my vulnerability set me up for success because it taught me, if he went ballistic, what he's going to be like to engage in the future. right? So on one hand, the vulnerability I did display really helped us work through some great stuff. If the VP was part of that 10% that thrives on conflict and he went ballistic and crazy and whatever, that is also really valuable for me as a leader working with him. So either way, the vulnerability is going to set me up for success.
That is a very elegant way of looking at that. I love that.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
So here's a question. How do you coach vulnerability? How do you encourage or get somebody to the point where they're willing to be more vulnerable?
Yeah. Because we don't work through those breaking points without vulnerability, hey, Brett. Yeah. Good question. I think what, for me anyway, and what I've experienced with the people that I serve is that vulnerability gets impeded when we get in our head about it. So with the VP high level example, I could have talked myself out of being vulnerable. Of who am I to tell this guy the feedback? He's not going to respect me. I'm new in the role. I should just give him the feedback and report back to the team that I shared it, and that's that. Like, I could have got in my head really diminishing the influence that I have, right? Because we all struggle with that feeling worthy and feeling valuable. Brené Brown just has some wonderful work around that. I could have easily bought into that head talk, and that impedes vulnerability. And the head talk really needs to be more about, if not me, who? I'm the right person to have this conversation. They approached me. It's okay to feel scared. You know, if I find myself biting my nails or, you know, doing whatever anxiety things I do, that's okay. You're anxious because this is important. You've got this. You know, and really talking yourself up to doing the vulnerable work versus talking yourself out of being vulnerable.
It also reminds me of the book that I did some research on, how people deal with fear. And the thing I realized about that is that fear is about comfort zones and being out of your comfort zone. And if you're way out of your comfort zone, then that's where the fear and the panic really sets in. So the intriguing thing about what you were doing of making yourself vulnerable and having those types of conversations is it stretches your comfort zone. You become a little bit more comfortable with putting yourself out there, being vulnerable. And the more you do that, the easier it becomes having that conversation the second and the third and the fourth time around.
Yes.
And then you just become better at it.
Yes.
And it applies to everybody.
Right. You've got it. Yep, you got it. It's those emotional intelligence muscles, right? The self-management to really build up vulnerability. When I do the tough conversations workshop, I tell my clients and teams and companies that I do it with, like, just leaning into those tough conversations. First one, super awkward. You practice it a million times. Second one, still kind of awkward, still practice a lot. Third, you know, it's going to be awkward, but you skip over those feelings and you just practice. Fourth, like, it exponentially gets better super fast. So you're right, like, leaning into vulnerability, it's heart-wrenching at first, and then you do it a couple of times and it just gets better and better, and you find yourself able to lean into it faster and easier, and it just, you see the wins out of it. How can you stop yourself from being vulnerable? Just, you know that there are all these great wins out of it. The communication improves, problem solving gets better, innovation, validation, all those things come out of being vulnerable. And so you just skip over the awkwardness and lean into it that much faster.
I want to step back a little bit. You've been working for quite a long time. What have you learned over the last 5-10 years that you think is really valuable and insightful? And that if you had to give somebody in a leadership position one piece of advice, what would it be?
Yeah, great question. Well, related to what we're talking about today, I've got a roundtable group, several groups that, you know, we come together and we talk, and I make the group slow down to actively listen to each other to help the individual talking about whatever they want to talk about, really think through whatever they need to think through. And part of the magic in that work is, as a facilitator of the roundtable, saying what I'm thinking. And so I encourage all of the participants in the roundtable, like, if you're thinking someone's not being honest with themselves, or if you're thinking you keep bringing this up and I don't know why you're stuck on it, or if you're thinking, gosh, what can I do to transition this person into being nicer? Or if you're thinking whatever you're thinking, just say it. So the trick with leading team discussions or getting vulnerable with people or having tough conversations, all of that stuff going on in your head, if you're thinking it, just say it. Otherwise, yeah, it's the elephant in your head that gets in the way.
that is kind of aligned with leaning into intuition as well, because a lot of that, some of that is intuition, not just rationalized thinking about things.
Yeah. If you're thinking it, the other person needs to hear it. And that's just very simply, it's going to help them. It's going to help the situation. Just say it and say it in really plain language. You know, they sort of in the coaching world talk about sentences that are 5 to 7 words, like super simple, elementary language. Let's not make it all fancy. I remember coaching someone years ago as a tiny example. The person had asked me for feedback. I'd done some observation. We were doing the debrief. And in the middle of the debrief, she just crossed her arms. Debrief was going fine. And in my head, I remember thinking, why has she crossed her arms? Like something shifted. And I remember just saying, I noticed you crossed your arms. Trigger. She wells up with tears, starts getting emotional and says, you know, I really struggle with feedback. I know I want to get better at this. I was okay until right then. And then we talked about what the trigger was of that thing when she, much better discussion had I not tried to like make sure she felt safe, made sure she felt comfortable, made sure I was saying things the right way to kind of undo whatever her arms crossing meant. No, just I noticed it. I said it. And that's when the conversation got richer.
Wow, that's amazing. If somebody wants to work with you, how do they get in touch with you? What type of work are you doing at the moment? What would you encourage people to reach out to you?
Yeah, that's great. So there's a few different ways that I can help people kind of slow down to work on that interpersonal communication. So carrieburchill.com is my website. You can certainly message me through that. I'm on LinkedIn, Carrie Burchill, Facebook, Carrie Burchill. My handle on Instagram, go figure, Carrie Burchill. So any of those ways works. And I have a few different things that I offer. I don't have a cookie cutter approach. So everything is tailored to where people are at and kind of the context and the environment that they work in. Broadly, though, there are 4 things that you can engage in. One is just one-on-one coaching or group coaching. 2 is the roundtable discussions, which is really leaders. I've done them where it's a selection of leaders within companies. It really helps with that collaboration and kind of slowing down and communicating. Or you can join a cohort that is leaders across the nation where they just make sense of their challenges. It's just that safe space where you can slow down, bounce off ideas with people. So one-on-one coaching, roundtables, leadership development, and then speaking engagements, workshops, that's where we talk about these things.
That sounds awesome. Tell me a little bit more about your, what did you call them, the roundtables? How do those work?
Yeah, so depending on if you want a roundtable within the organization or do you want to just as a leader be a part of a roundtable? We get together once a month for 90 minutes and everybody has some time during the meeting to talk about how they're showing up as leaders. So the focus isn't on operational challenges. The focus is on how you show up as a leader to achieve those operational outcomes. And so the group really helps you hear yourself, helps you see, helps you identify where your next steps are. And ultimately, it ends up being this really great group of colleagues. I've had groups like stay in it for 4 or 5 years straight because they just love the connection. They get together outside of our meetings. They call each other for advice and just to kind of kick tires. So it's that space where you grow yourself and you help other people grow in this really safe, open, vulnerable environment.
How many people are in each of the round tables?
Yeah, we aim for about 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, I facilitate them. I'm part of every meeting. And we really have a high expectation of attendance because if one person's missing, it just shifts the dynamics of the group. Now, of course, things do come up, but the real work is that consistency of being together and helping each other slow down so that you can see where the opportunities are and what you need to do to work those opportunities.
Yeah, I find those types of groups incredibly valuable. I've been in a similar structure where it's called the mastermind. I run my own masterminds as well. Mm-hmm. And I find that it's one of the best learning environments where you really get to the heart of the issues. There's a lot of safety and trust involved. You build up really good relationships with people.
Yeah.
And the learning is just out of this world.
I consistently hear people say, oh, it's so nice to not feel alone. Well, yeah, you do. I mean, the lonely at the top, right? That is something that we hear leaders say all the time. And that's the beautiful thing of like the masterminds you run, my roundtables. The trick is just to find a group that you feel you fit with. And so we can definitely set you up with that.
That's awesome. Carrie, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a fantastic discussion. I really enjoyed it.
What a pleasure for me. You take care, Brett.
Thanks for listening. Please go to the website changeleadership.info, where you'll find the show notes for this episode with all the contact details, links, downloads, and other useful resources. If you'd like to join me as a guest on this podcast, there's a registration link on the About page. But most importantly, if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe for more and share this podcast with one or two other people you know who you think might find it useful or inspiring. I'd also like to encourage you to leave a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. That tells the algorithms that the content is valuable, and it puts it in front of more people who could benefit from listening to the thought leaders and change agents that I speak to on this show. And that helps content creators like me to keep going. In the meantime, why not do a search on the website for more episodes that you might find inspiring, and let's spend some more time together.